tell you about these ideas. I'm going to focus on a very concrete kind of problem today. I mean, I thought a lot about what would be appropriate at a conference about stacks, and maybe I came to a bad conclusion. But it's about the irreducibility of a specific moduli space. And I'll try to explain how it fits into a classical context, but only when we introduce some algebraic stacks into the picture to help us push it into a classical context. So X is going to be a smooth projective surface and it's going to be living over an algebraically closed field for the sake of simplicity. And I'm also going to choose some integer n, which is invertible in that field. The theorem I'd like to describe to you today says roughly the following. The space, well, I could say stack, I guess, in this room, of stable PGLN bundles on X with fixed cohomology class, which I'll define later, and sufficiently large second turn classes, I'll also comment on in a moment, is irreducible. Okay, well, part of being irreducible is that it's non-empty, so this is not actually true. What I really mean is it's non-empty for arbitrarily large. There are arbitrarily large values of C2 for which it is non-empty, and whenever it is non-empty, it's irreducible in that asymptotic way. Now, the study of G bundles is something which has occupied a lot of attention over time, and I think there are pretty good results when studying G bundles on curves. On surfaces, there's much less known. Really, all that's known, as far as I understand this, is for things like, okay, GM, and then GLN or SLN, things like that. Okay. But I'd like to explain how this fits into a classical context in which people prove that various moduli spaces are irreducible. And very broadly speaking, I guess especially for those of you with a topological background, the idea is to compactify this moduli problem and then use degeneration methods and deformation theory to try to connect points together, and then some homological properties of the moduli space will ensure that it's connected or irreducible or whatever we want it to be. So I'll just state a very vague principle, which is degeneration plus deformation, if we understand these things well enough, they can lead us to prove irreducibility results. Okay. So let me give you the two sort of classical examples. In both cases, I guess, let me also add this to this immovable, this board which will never move again. The key is always, or at least it appears to always be, to find a nice compactification of the moduli problem. There's often many options. I mean, for example, if I take any compactification, I could do a blow-up in the complement of the part I'm interested in. I mean, that's not very intelligent, but I could do that. So the key is to find some kind of intelligent compactification. And often, intelligent means that the boundary of the moduli problem gives me some kind of inductive structure which relates the part I'm adding to other moduli spaces in which I'm interested. So rather than just vaguely talk about this, let me give you maybe the first or best example of this. If one is interested in, say, proving things about the moduli space of smooth curves of genus G, then it has proven useful to compactify it by stable curves. So MG is going to be the stack of smooth curves of genus G. And this turns out to be irreducible, but the proof, at least the proof to Dedekind and Mumford, goes by connecting points together, not in the smooth locus, but by moving them through a boundary and connecting them by curves in a boundary. So MG gets embedded inside this thing, MG bar, which is a stack of stable curves. I'm not going to define those. It doesn't really matter. And now the idea is that I can degenerate any smooth curve to a nodal union of curves of lower genus. So I could degenerate, so given some C in MG, I can degenerate, you know, to a union like this, where you have a curve of genus G minus 1 and a curve of genus 1, or something like that. And now by induction on the genus, So if I take any two curves, I degenerate them to nodal unions like this, I can move the pieces to line up, and then I can move the attachment point. I can do this all in a connected way. I can connect points. And then finally, some smoothness coming from deformation theory tells me that connectedness implies irreducibility. So I guess I could draw a picture. Here we have, you know, MG bar, sitting inside it is MG. We start with any two points in MG. We move them to the boundary so that they have this form. Then we use induction to know that we can connect the boundary points together. And so MG bar is connected, therefore if it's smooth, it's irreducible. So the open subsec MG is also irreducible, and that's a proof. So even if you're only interested in smooth curves, it's very nice that you have this compactification where it's easier to connect points by passing through boundary strata, which give us an inductive structure. The second classical example of this phenomenon is much more complicated, but it has a similar feel to it, and that is the stack of stable vector bundles with a fixed determinant, say, on a surface. And I'm not even going to give this a name because this is never going to come up again. So here, we also have a nice, we have a good candidate. Oh, maybe I should put some names. I don't know. Names are good, right? Probably, actually, putting names is a good way to offend people, because I'm probably going to leave off some names. So Donaldson, Giesecker, Lee, O'Grady, various other people were involved in studying these spaces, which are quite complicated in general, but have a nice structure when the second Trinquest is allowed to get very large, similar to what happens there. So here, if I take a vector bundle, it's clear what I should be allowed to degenerate it to. I should be allowed to degenerate it to a torsion-free sheaf. So I can degenerate to torsion-free sheaves. So these are going to be the boundary points. Now, if I take such a torsion-free sheaf, so again, this X, I mean, X is always going to mean the same thing. It's this smooth projective surface. A torsion-free sheaf sits inside its reflexive hull, and the length of the co-kernel is finite. And in particular, I guess, C2 of this double dual is less than C2 of F. And and also F double dual is locally free. So in other words, if I take one of these boundary points, one of these torsion-free sheaves, if I take its double dual, I get some kind of vibration over a moduli space of locally free sheaves with a lower second Trinquest. And now some very delicate numerical results allow me to use this kind of inductive vibration picture to get results like irreducibility on the moduli space. So this kind of delicate numerical stuff yields some kind of induction using this happy, happy boundary. All right. So it's going to turn out that the stack of PGLN bundles is much closer to the stack of sheaves than it is to the stack of curves. But it's kind of hard to imagine, well, for me, anyway, if I give you a group G and I ask you to tell me what should the boundary points be, what should I let G bundles degenerate to, it's kind of hard to figure out what that should be. In the case of PGLN, however, we get lucky. Or maybe it's not lucky. I don't know. Maybe someone once said to me there's no such thing as a coincidence in mathematics. But it sort of seems like a coincidence. So PGLN lives already in geometry and in arithmetic. I mean, it has various realizations that give us other models for this moduli space where it will be easier to figure out what the boundary points should be. So, the first one, well, this one actually doesn't tell us anything about boundary points, but it does lead me to a question, which I'll ask you later. PGLN is the automorphism sheaf of PN minus 1. Okay, that's something that we all learn sometime in our lives. And in arithmetic, PGLN also plays a fundamental role because it's the sheaf of automorphisms of the scheme of n by n matrices. So these, of course, are true over Z. I mean, these are completely, these are universal facts about PGLN. This is somehow a very useful thing. Now, this comes from the Skolem-Miller theorem, which I'm going to write on the board because it's going to appear again later. And what it says is if I take some V, which is locally free, then I can identify the sheaf of automorphisms of the sheaf of endomorphisms of V as a sheaf of algebras. So this sequence, I take an automorphism of V, I send it to the action by conjugation, which gives me an automorphism of the sheaf of endomorphisms of V as an algebra. This is actually surjective. All the automorphisms are locally inner, and of course the scalars are exactly those that give rise to the trivial automorphism. Okay, so this is the Skolem-Miller theorem, and so you see in the case of a trivial thing, you know, V is free, then this gives this result. So then this is PJ. Okay. So now I remind you that descent theory now tells us a couple of things. That are ultimately kind of interesting, I guess. So if I start with PGLN bundles on X, all right, well, first of all, what I mean, maybe I should have been, well, you can define them any way you want, and you'll get the same thing. And up to isomorphism, all you get is H1 of the Etal side of X with coefficients in PGLN. In other words, any PGLN torsor, however you slice it, has Etal local sections. And now by just applying these observations, I see that this also parameterizes two other things potentially of interest to us. The first is I can take proper flat morphisms with fibers Pn minus 1. Okay, that's the same as forms of Pn minus 1. So some geometric version of the space of PGLN bundles where things are proper, which is nice for things like the existence theorem or whatever. And another thing is that we can compare PGLN bundles to some algebras. So forms of Mn of O. All right, so let me remind you, these forms of Mn of O, they have a life of their own. In algebra. They are Azumaya algebras. And I guess I should, I'll just give a definition. But let me just point out that the nice thing about the bottom one there is that those are coherent sheaves. They have some additional structure, but they're some kind of coherent model for the moduli problem. And so maybe we could hope that it will be easier or something to find what the boundary points should be if we start with some coherent model for this. All right. So I'm actually going to think about the problem in those terms, and so since I want to say the word Azumaya algebra, I'm going to write the word Azumaya algebra words. Okay. So an Azumaya algebra of degree n. So first, this is going to look really stupid. Is a form of Mn. Okay, now in case there's somebody in this room who doesn't know what this means, or who isn't used to this terminology, what I mean is that this is a sheaf of algebras, so a sheaf of OX algebras, such that on some Etal cover, it becomes n by n matrices. So there exists an Etal surjection, U to X, such that A restricted to U is isomorphic to n by n matrices over the structure sheaf of U. And this is just saying Etal locally on X, this thing looks like endomorphisms of a free or locally free sheaf, however you want to think about it. Okay. So we see again, just to restate what I said a moment ago, to study moduli of PGL... Did somebody say something? No, I guess that was a nose. Okay. Moduli of PGLN bundles... Okay, this is going to be the same thing as moduli of Azumaya algebras of degree n. And because of my training, this is somehow easier for me to think about. I apologize if this makes it more confusing for you. Yes. Okay. So, now another one of these memes that's everywhere in the study of moduli problems in algebraic geometry is that you should first look for some discrete invariants, and then once you've found as many as you can, you pray that the remaining part is really truly continuous, like irreducible or something like that. So let me describe to you what the basic invariants are of these Azumaya algebras. And that will define some of the terms I have in the theorem out there. All right, so there's basically three invariants, but two of them are almost the same thing. So the first is, since we have these coherent sheaves, we can just take their Chern classes, I guess. All right, so we have the, so A is going to be some Azumaya algebra of degree n. All right, so we have the Chern classes of A. And now it's not very hard to see that, in fact, C1 is trivial. So there's really only, since we're on the surface, one interesting Chern class, and that's C2. So C2 is where all the action is. And specifying C2 is roughly the same, is the same as specifying the Hilbert polynomial if you choose the polarization of the surface. Okay, but I think it's nicer to just have one number instead of a beast. Okay, now 2 and 3, well, they actually kind of come from viewing these things as PGLN torsors. And these are cohomological invariants that we get from the boundary in non-abelian cohomology. So I guess another one, the Skolem-Noether theorem is telling us a very nice presentation or central extension, or however you want to think about it, of PGLN, and it's saying that it's a quotient of GLN by GM. And, of course, there's a similar fact if I look at it as a quotient of SLN. But now I'm only modding out by this tiny little group of nth roots of unity. And so from this, if I non-abelian cohomologize it, I get this triangle of mass. This is all happening in a tall cohomology. If you don't want X to be invertible, you can do this in flat cohomology, whatever. Okay. So if I start with some A, I get a cohomology class here, which I'll call the class of A. And we'll come back to what that's measuring in a moment. Now, the Chern classes are known. I mean, if we take a flat family of these Azumaya algebras, it's easy to see that this is going to be invariant. And from the proper and smooth base change theorems in a tall cohomology, it's also easy to see that this class will remain invariant. So these truly are discrete invariants when I look at flat families of Azumaya algebras, when I look at things that I'm interested in this moduli problem. All right. So I can at least give a name to what I'm interested in. I can sort of write down some symbols that will stand for this moduli problem with the invariants attached. So if I fix some gamma in H2 of X mu n and some C in Z, then, I have the stack of Azumaya algebras with cohomology class gamma on X of degree n and second Chern class C. So this is the stack whose sections over some K-scheme P are Azumaya algebras of degree n on the product such that every fiber has the invariance we like, such that for all geometric points T bar of T, the restriction of A to T bar has class gamma, and the degree of its second Chern class is C. Okay, now it's formal that this is an algebraic stack, more or less. What's not so formal is that it's a kind of tiny algebraic stack. But, let me add a hypothesis, which will just remain in effect forever and ever, just to make our lives simpler. And that is that the image of gamma in H2 of GM has order n. In other words, these are Azumaya algebras, which are maximal orders in a division algebra over the function field of X, if you think in those terms. So under this hypothesis, which is now going to remain in effect forever. So I might not write it all the time. We have that this stack of Azumaya algebras is a separated... What? I guess in this way, I mean, so starting with mu n, I suppose it is. In general, it's a bit more mysterious. But it's, I mean, I can explain to you later why it is a natural condition. Yep. Okay. But no, I mean, in full generality, no. It's not an open condition if I just think of a class here, but if I know it comes from something, if I know it's n-torsion, then I think it's an open condition, yeah? Okay, so, right. So this is a separated DM stack of finite type over the base field. So it's a cute, hopefully manageable moduli space. No funny business. The invariants have at least pinned down enough of the structure that we only have to look at a bit of it at once to guess if there are other components. Okay. It's not, in general, proper. For certain values of C2, it actually will be proper. In general, it won't be proper, and one can prove that if C2 grows, it cannot be proper. But that's sort of part of the package that I'm describing to you. All right, so now our goal is to prove that this thing is irreducible for large C2. Okay. Goal. Again, with this caveat about non-emptiness. So let's see. Okay, and the non-emptiness is a very serious mathematical problem. But, I mean, it has a solution. And we're not going to talk about it. Yes. That's a good question. Maybe you can tell me. Can someone tell me what that means in terms of the PGLN bundle? Because I don't really know about these bundle things. I mean, I know in the algebra land, it just means that the generic fiber is a division algebra. And that to me seems like a very natural way to think about it. I don't know about this.
In terms of the browser variety?
No, in terms of the PGLN torsor. Yeah, it's kind of, it seems mysterious to me in those terms, but maybe there's some natural way to say it. Yes. And I should say, I mean, what I'm going to be describing to you, I mean, with this hypothesis, is all that's actually written down in a paper.
What you're saying is that it does not have any reductional structure group for parabolic subgroup.
Okay, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. But maybe that's right. Okay. So if we want to follow this old style pattern, we should figure out how to compactify this baby. And I guess we get some kind of a hint from knowing what the local structure of Azumaya algebras is. I mean, locally, we have that, you know, A is just n of V. Ah, one loop too many. And we know how V should degenerate. We know that V should be allowed to go to something that's torsion-free in the boundary. And so we might hope that n of V should be allowed to go to something like n of F in the boundary. It seems reasonable. Unfortunately, there's a problem, which is that this is not a flat degeneration. Okay, now what I mean by that is that the formation of the sheaf of endomorphisms does not commute with base change in general. But there is one setting where everything is flat and everything commutes with everything else, and that is the derived category. So, to fix this, well, maybe this is not readable. This is kind of important. So the fix is that instead of degenerating end of V to end of F, we should actually degenerate V to R hom, R sheaf hom, from F to F. See, since V is locally free, we can't actually tell the difference between end of V and R hom from V to V. But when V is not locally free, there is a difference, and actually that's sort of necessary to make things sufficiently flat that the modular problem becomes tractable. So, let me give you a more formal definition of this thing. This is going to give us generalized Azumaya algebras. Right. So generalized Azumaya algebra of degree n on X is an algebra object of the derived category. So this can mean any nice derived category of sheaves that you like, let's say with quasi-coherent or coherent cohomology or whatever, it doesn't really matter, such that etal locally it has this form here. So there exists an etal surjection, U surjecting onto X, such that, two such that's I guess is kind of bad style. When I restrict, so let's call this object A. When I restrict A to U, it becomes isomorphic to R hom, and I mean quasi-isomorphic, from F to F, where F is torsion-free of rank R. N. It's a definition. Now there's some magic which happens. Is there a question coming from somewhere? Yes. It is very weak. And I think that these infinite people, like him, have some other way of doing this. Or, I mean, in the recesses of your brain, you have another way of doing this that is better. Okay. But the magic is that on a surface, these things, I mean, you know, a surface over a field or whatever, these things do form a stack. Now, there's this sort of minor technical irritant, which is that when you talk about stacks over K, you might be talking about stacks on the category of all K schemes or on the category of affine K schemes. And here I mean it's a stack on the category of affine schemes. But sort of categorically speaking, this doesn't really matter. It only matters for psychology, and maybe if you try to think about what the universal object should be. In general, you have to stackify. I mean, if you want to do so, I think you can stackify this. You get a nice stack, well, because you've stackified it. And in fact, when you stackify, it becomes a subfibered category of the fibered category of derived categories. So you kind of cut yourself down. It's kind of weird. You don't actually enlarge things, but that's really gross. Okay, but that is what makes me think that it's some kind of a truncation of an infinity stack, and I'm just doing this like a thumb-sucking babe. All right. Now, if we want to get a handle on what these things look like, it would be nice to have something like the Skolem-Noether theorem, and there is such a thing. So, again, I'm just going to state this in the context of surfaces. There are more general things which are true. So, given a torsion-free sheaf F, so again on this X, okay, or any local model for X, the natural sequence, again I have this I can conjugate by an automorphism to get an automorphism of this derived endomorphism algebra. So I have a sequence like this. One goes to GM, goes to the sheaf of automorphisms of F, goes to the sheaf of automorphisms, well, the thing, which turns out to be a sheaf of automorphisms of R-hom from F to F. This is given by conjugation. This comes from the fact that it's central. This is exact. So this is like a derived form of the Skolem-Noether theorem. And again, I think there are infinity categorical versions of this. Now, a consequence of this or of various other observations one can make is that any generalized Azumaya algebra of degree n has a cohomology class in H2 of mu n. So any generalized Azumaya algebra A of degree n has class of A in H2 of X mu n. One dirty way to see this is that any generalized Azumaya algebra is actually Azumaya away from finitely many points. The derivedness is actually concentrated on a zero-dimensional locus. And so you get a cohomology class defined over most of the surface, and that's why, that's one way you can see that you have a cohomology class on the surface itself. From that point of view, it's a little bit less clear that this is constant in a flat family, but in fact it is. And let me tell you, I guess I should say what a flat family is. But let me also, let me point out that there's also Chern classes. Also, so A is perfect. So it has yummy Chern classes. And again, we have that C1 is equal to 0, and so we just have this C2. So we've got a cohomology class, and we've got a C2. So let me leave that board as it is. I guess I should say, please interrupt me at any time if you have a question or you think something is really awful. Okay. So I have a stack of generalized Azumaya algebras, which deserves a name. Is there a question? I heard a whispering sound. Okay. Oh, maybe you think it's really awful. So this is going to be, by analogy, just like up there, we're going to take families of algebras. We have to be a little bit careful because the derived category, things are just kind of too flat. So we have to impose an additional flatness condition. So it's going to be the stack with sections over some affine, T mapping the stack of K, generalized Azumaya algebras of degree N on X cross T such that, now there are a couple of conditions. So first of all, the local sheaves of A are T flat. Okay, so what I really mean is that this is locally R-Hom from a flat family of torsion-free sheaves to itself. And second, the geometric fibers have the prescribed invariance. So for all J mapping a geometric point to T, if I take the derived pullback of A, then this is going to be a generalized Azumaya algebra of degree N on the fiber. And it has cohomology class gamma and the degree of C2 of this thing is C. All right. So there's some moduli problem there. And now the inevitable comes. This stack is also a happy stack. I wrote this as a theorem, but I think this is just a proposition. So again, given star, star holds, this thing, GAZ, upper gamma sub X of NC, is a proper DM stack. Over K, containing this Azumaya thing as an open substack. I'm not saying it's a dense open substack because, in general, that's not clear. In the same way that it's not particularly clear, probably, I'm not sure if it's true, in fact, that torsion-free sheaves contain locally free sheaves as a dense open subproblem. That may not, in general, be true. This is going to be true asymptotically. So for large C2, in fact, this will become a dense open. And so it's only in the limit that we can see that these things are, that this is really a sort of meaningful compactification of the stack of Azumaya algebras. All right, so now we've got this proper thing. It's a compactification. It has boundary points that we can kind of understand. They have at least a nice local structure. Now we can try to figure out how to study this thing. Just making it is not really an achievement because we don't have any clue what it looks like. One question that I have is, what do the boundary points look like if I think about this from the point of view of PGLN bundles or PN minus 1 bundles? So, I mean, do the boundary points have a nice interpretation from these other viewpoints? From the viewpoint, this feels non-grammatical, of PGLN bundles or PN minus 1 bundles? Question mark? I mean, is there some way of making some kind of derived Severi Brouwer scheme in one of these things? Yes? They have the same expected dimension. Because you compute it just in terms of the invariance. I mean, it's some formula involving the Euler characteristic. It just comes from the deformation theory.
I mean, the first one, the one that you imagine, a proportion, can you realize
it as a proportion? In general, no. What's funny is that in the general case, you can kind of prove that these things have properties you would expect from GIT without being able to show that it comes from GIT. Sometimes you can show it comes from GIT, sometimes you can't. But maybe GIT doesn't matter. I mean, we should try to figure out how to avoid using GIT, I think, as mathematicians. All right. What am I doing? Yes, okay. So maybe I should give you, I mean, maybe I should point out one kind of example of these things, which is what happens if gamma is zero. So this is not going to have any relevance for this because I'm assuming this condition where gamma is as non-zero as possible. But let me just mention what the things look like when gamma is zero. I mean, it's not surprising at all. If gamma is zero, in fact, this local picture turns out to be a global picture. So if gamma, this is too stumpy. If gamma is zero, then any A, you know, with class gamma, maybe that's a bad way to write it, has the form is isomorphic to, quasi-isomorphic to, one of these R-hom from FF. So just as you might expect, the cohomology class is measuring how local the local structure is. Now, to get a better handle, I mean, now we want to actually do, so for example, we'd like to prove that this thing is irreducible. Then we'll show that this open thing is irreducible if we've proven that it's not empty. And to do that, I think it's probably a good idea to get a better grip on what this gamma really is, because it just came from some exact sequence. So all we know is it's a cohomology class, but it's better maybe to have some kind of geometric realization of gamma, and here's where the stacks in geometry and topology part comes in, I think. So there's a theorem due to Giroux, which tells us where to look for some kind of geometric realization of these cohomology classes. And he tells us, in this special case, that H2 of X mu n parametrizes isomorphism classes of mu n gerbs. So I'll just say what a mu n gerb is, but don't worry about it too much. Okay, I'll say it in a few different ways. Maybe everyone knows what a mu n gerb is. I don't know. So a mu n gerb is, okay, it's a stack, curly X, mapping to X, such that, first of all, X is the sheafification of curly X. And second, there is an identification, a fixed isomorphism between mu n and the inertia stack of curly X. All right. That's one way to say this. more colloquially, okay, I guess topologically or something like that. Although, you know, I don't, maybe you guys know how to make topology work over FP bar, but I don't know. It's a B mu n bundle. Ah, okay. And if you really just want to think about it without worrying, then you should think that it has the same points as X, same points as X, but it has a mu n of automorphisms at each one. And now, from this point of view, I mean, from that sort of colloquial point of view, it's a little bit hard to understand what would be non-trivial about this thing. But in fact, these things can be non-trivial, even if their automorphism groups are always canonically identified. So topologically, I mean, algebra geometrically, topologically, or something, we haven't really changed X, but we've added some stacky fuzz. We have a stacky model of our surface, where we have some automorphism groups that are going to do good things for us. Okay. So now the question is, you know, which mu n gerb corresponds to gamma? So we have this cohomology class. How do we get the gerb that corresponds to it? Well, it's a stack on X, and it solves a moduli problem associated to X schemes. And it's a moduli problem, which is trivializing the generalized Azumaya algebra. You see, when the class is zero, that should correspond to when it's trivial, when it's just Arham for something to itself. And in fact, the pattern is that this gerb is precisely the moduli of trivialization. So if it doesn't have a section, if it's non-trivial, there won't be a global trivialization like that. Now, this gets a little bit hairy for totally generalized Azumaya algebras, but I'm going to write this down anyway. A trivialization of A is a triple, so on, you know, on some T mapping to X is a triple F phi delta, where S is a perfect complex on T with cohomology at zero and lower, but at zero, I'm not going to, you know, so. So don't allow it to shift as much as you want. Okay, phi is an isomorphism between the derived pullback of A to T and this Arham thing, and delta is a trivialization of the determinant of F. Okay, maybe it's easy to think about this just for an Azumaya algebra. So here I take a locally free sheaf. Yes.
So in practice, how long are
these complex? They go out to 2. Something like that, with appropriate numbering of the indices. Okay. Maybe a minus 2. Okay. So in terms of PGON bundles, this is, and if you forget about the singular points, this is just the moduli problem of reducing the structure group to SLN. So this is sort of like moduli of reduction of structure group to SLN, which is it's how you get the coboundary map. Okay, this is in Giroux's book, by the way, in some form or another. And you should all read it. All right. Now, it is not so hard to see that this is actually, this defines a moduli problem on X, and it has an algebraic solution. So this problem has an algebraic solution, which is a muon gerb. So there exists an algebraic solution, which is a mu n gerb, curly X to X. And the mu n part, the automorphisms of objects, come from just scalar multiplications on the F. So mu n X by scalar multiplication. Now, this is a solution to a moduli problem, so there's going to be some universal object. So there's going to be some universal triple like that. So we've got some F universal on curly X, and we have an isomorphism between A restricted to curly X and RHOM from F to F. And we have a trivialization of the determinant of F. Now, this F universal is not, so a sheaf on a B mu n bundle has a decomposition into eigensheaves. Each fiber of the gerb has a mu n acting as automorphism, so any sheaf has fibers mu n representations, and if you pay careful attention to what's going on, you see that in fact any sheaf on X is a direct sum of eigensheaves. Any sheaf G on X, on curly X, has a realization as some direct sum of G chi, where chi is in Z mod n, indexing the characters. And in the case of this universal sheaf, the fact that the mu n gerb structure comes from just scalar multiplication tells us that this is not any sheaf, it's a special kind of sheaf. So we see that F universal is actually equal to its eigen subbundle with a 1 here, where the 1 doesn't mean 0, it means scalar multiplication, it means injection of mu n into GM character. Okay. Any questions? So it looks like we're able to rescue what happens with the trivial class. As long as we take a stacky model of the surface, if we fix the cohomology class, when we take a stacky model of the surface, this mu n gerb over the surface, then our generalized Adjumaya algebras actually become just these RHOM from F to F, where F is some torsion-free sheaf with this property here. And so this is helping us to transform the moduli problem that we're interested in, namely things about generalized Adjumaya algebras, into some kind of moduli problem similar to something we're familiar with, namely torsion-free sheaves. But now we have to do it on a kind of stacky surface. So this is where, without thinking stackily, it's a little bit hard to truly understand this moduli problem, but this is how we can insert this picture into the classical context. So these sheaves have a name. I don't know why, but they do. An X-twisted sheaf. Maybe this is just meant to confuse the listener and or reader, is one of these things. So an X-twisted sheaf is a sheaf on X such that mu n acts by scalar multiplications on the fibers. All right. And now what we've just seen over here, more or less, is that any generalized Adjumaya algebra with class gamma, which is the class of one of these gerbs, has the form, we can make this something global, RHOM from F to F, where F is a torsion-free coherent X-twisted sheaf. Okay, so maybe this is all content-free. And so, of course, we get that formation of RHOM from thing to thing gives us a map from the space of twisted sheaves to the space of generalized Adjumaya algebras. It gives us a covering of the space of generalized Adjumaya algebras by some moduli space of sheaves. So the map F goes to RHOM from F to F, gives a map. All right, let's see. So it goes from GAZ, oops, it goes from, oh, yeah. Something which I haven't yet really defined for you, to GAZ like this. I'll define this in a second. So I get a map of stacks from this stack of twisted sheaves to the stack of generalized Adjumaya algebras, and it restricts to a map from the locally free twisted sheaves to the Adjumaya algebras. So here TW X of NC is the stack of twisted sheaves, stack of torsion-free coherent x-twisted sheaves of rank n, and second Chern class equal to C, and this is some rational number. Okay, I use the rational Chow theory of the stack or something like that to get a good theory of Chern classes, and then they have to have denominators. The denominators are divide n, and it turns out that they form, this is an algebraic stack, so we have this analogous proposition, Tw sub x of nc is a proper DM stack over k. Oh, and this map here, yes, what? Oh, yes, thank you. With trivialized, I forgot to mention this, determinant. Yes, thank you very much. And this map has, so from the Skolem-Noether theorem, you can see that this map has a particularly nice property, if you're interested, and if you care, which is that this is a, so to speak, pick of x bracket n torsor. Now, one consequence of that, by the way, is that if I have a virtual fundamental class on the space of sheaves, I can actually make one by some kind of splitting trace construction on this space of PGLN bundles. So not only does this give a nice compactification which permits us to study irreducibility questions, it also gives something that has a virtual fundamental class and things like that. Okay. And I guess there's a second part of this, maybe this is a theorem. Not only is this a nice compact moduli space, if C2 is sufficiently large, it's actually irreducible. All right. So if C is sufficiently large, Twx of nc is irreducible. Again, with this caveat about non-emptiness and so on. All right. Now, no, because n is prime to the characteristic. Yeah. It's an interesting question what happens when p divides n if you're in characteristic p. So it turns out that the geometry of these spaces is very similar to the geometry of moduli spaces of sheaves. And I think when P divides the rank, people don't have a very good understanding of moduli spaces of sheaves. So in fact, now the proof of part two is formally similar to the proof of the analogous theorem for actual sheaves. I could try to sketch for you very vaguely how it works, and then I'll stop. But the point here is that this mechanism, this sort of absurd mechanism, where you just do one stupid thing after another, reduces the study of this originally potentially interesting moduli problem, like PGLN bundles, to a moduli space that is formally identical in many ways to the space of sheaves on a surface where there are already a lot of techniques that allow us to study the moduli and prove connectedness and irreducibility results. So maybe I'll try to vaguely, so idea of two. If I look at the boundary, which corresponds to torsion-free sheaves, I can stratify it according to the co-length, the length of the co-kernel when I stick something inside its reflexive hull. So I can stratify the boundary of this thing according to co-length. So I've got some F sitting inside F double dual with some quotient Q, and the co-length is the length of Q. Now, for fixed co-length, I get a fibration from some stratum of a given co-length to a moduli space where I have some lower C prime, well, some lower C2. And the fibers are these quotient schemes, the quotients of some locally free thing with some given length over this stack. So I can take the boundary and unscrew it into pieces that correspond to parts I'm interested in. Maybe this is the locally free part. And whose fibers are these spaces that are very concrete, these schemes of quotients. And these turn out to be irreducible. And we can compute their dimensions and so on. And now, okay, the point is that the structure that you get from these fibrations along with the estimated dimensions of these moduli spaces and the known dimensions of these quotient schemes are enough to, if we pay a lot of attention and do some slightly difficult things that I didn't invent, I mean, they just sort of work the same way as they do in the classical case, you gradually build up enough numerical information that you get a bigger and bigger locus of things that are totally unobstructed, very smooth and yummy, and then you can make sure that the boundary has, just like in the case of curves where you degenerate it to genus G minus 1 and genus 1, you can make sure that for sufficiently large C2, you can degenerate a locally free thing so that there's a boundary point where there's only one singular point and the co-length is as small as possible, and then this gives you a very tight control over all the irreducible components as C2 grows, and eventually they kind of just come together. So I guess maybe I should just say like the sort of final key step, key result, key step, is if I start with two locally free V and W in locally free, okay, there exist finite quotients. There exists V going to Q, W going to Q prime, such that I can connect the kernel of these things. So V bar and W bar now lie in the boundary of some higher space. But just like in the case of stable curves, I know by some magic that they're actually connected. They lie in a connected family. And now this gives me a contraction of all the connected components as I increase C2, and eventually they all get squashed down to one, so it becomes irreducible. So it's a much more complicated induction than in the case of curves, but certainly I think you would agree that it's at least tractable, and it gives us a result about something where it's not at least immediately obvious how to proceed. Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, so if I take some f, then the deformation, so the obstruction is in the traceless x2 from f to f, the obstruction to deforming it with fixed determinant. Actually, this works when p does not divide n. When p doesn't divide n, you have to be a little bit more careful. And the deformations come from traceless x1. Yes. And the traceless x0, if f is stable, which is sort of happening because of a hypothesis, then the traceless x0 is 0. So this is where you get a perfect obstruction theory and things like that.